Welcome to Season 5 of the Prosthetics and Orthotics Podcast with Joris Peels and Brent Wright. We're bringing in industry experts, patients, vendors, and thought leaders to share their stories, insights, and visions for the future. Whether you're a clinician, a researcher, a vendor, or someone with a personal interest in the field, we have something for you. Join us as we delve into how advancements in personalized healthcare and 3D printing are revolutionizing the industry and changing the way we approach the design, production, and delivery of prosthetic and orthotic devices.
Hello, everyone. My name is Joris Peels, and this is another edition of the Prosthetic and Orthotics Podcast with Brent Wright. How are you doing, Brent?
Oh, man, doing well. I'm really excited about today's guest, but I'm also excited about our sponsors that sponsor this episode.
And who is our sponsor, Brent?
So our title sponsor is Advanced 3D. And the neat thing about Advanced 3D is I'm a part of that. It's something that I am really excited about moving forward with. And we're a contract manufacturer for specifically for prosthetics and orthotics, but we do a whole bunch of other things. And the whole idea is to really come alongside of anybody that's looking at the technology and really being their guide, meeting them wherever they are, if they're looking at software, if they're looking at 3D printers, if they want to print, whatever it is, we want to help them and really just advance this kind of initiative of 3D printing and O&P going forward. And we want to help as many people as we can, not only here in the U.S., but really worldwide. And that's what kind of anchors our passion is. We believe that 3D printing will create access to those that would otherwise not have access to a prosthesis.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. This is one. And so one of the things you do, so you can help me with my design, or you could help me invent something, or you can help me develop something.
That's right. A lot of people will say, hey, Brent, I've got this idea, and I have this thing that's cobbled together with, you know, toothpicks and a glue stick and hot glue and all that. Can you make it for us? And we can absolutely create it and get it ready for 3D printing or other sort of fabrication if you need it.
Okay, sounds really cool. And are any particular technologies you're using or kind of printers you have, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so we use our Multijet Fusion. We have a production Multijet Fusion printer from Hewlett Packard. We also run the Multijet Fusion 580, which is a full color printer. And we run nylon 11, nylon 12, and TPU. And then we have access to a whole bunch of other materials through our various partners. But those are our main ones that we're really excited on and we use on a daily basis.
Well, super cool. And thank you, Brent, for sponsoring us.
Yeah, kind of crazy. Well, there's three of us. So it's make up Advanced 3D. So it's Paul, Tyler, and myself. And we've had them on the show. But yeah, we had to clear it with everybody. But they were like, let's do this.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right, dude. And so who do we have on the podcast today?
I'm really excited about having Matt Mikus on the podcast today. He's doing a lot of cool stuff in the upper extremities, specifically in the partial hand realm. I really like that he uses freeform and a lot of powder-based fusion type of stuff in his process. So I'm looking forward to knowing more about that today.
Okay, cool, man. Welcome to the show, Matt. And so, Matt, how'd you get involved with O&P?
So I've been in the field for about 25 years now, and my earliest recollection probably was when I was a kid, my great-grandmother lost her leg due to diabetes. So that was kind of my first recollection of prosthetics, and really didn't spark an interest back then. But as I started to go through college, I started to realize, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and I was always into health and fitness, and I always loved working with people, but I always loved working with my hands as well. So I grew up working in workshops with my father and making cabinets and stuff like that, and I just always loved working with my hands. But I always wanted to be around people and working with people, and when I realized what prosthetics and orthotics was, I'm like, man, this is exactly what I want to do. I get to see patients, make their lives better, and also build stuff. To me, it was just a perfect combination. And I love every day I go to work.
Okay, that's very good. That's very good. And so at what point did you try to kind of specialize, or were you, did you do kind of like all sorts of stuff in the beginning? How did you end up like, yeah, in the area where you are now?
Yeah, I've always had a passion for upper limb prosthetics and more specifically partial hand technology, because back when I started, there was very limited options out there for the partial hand patients. So I always struggled every time I'd see a partial hand patient come into the office and, you know, they're asking me what their options were, and I really didn't have much to show them, you know, so that kind of, sparked my interest. You know, I'm not an engineer by trade, but I've always wanted to design things. And, you know, once I started to realize that there's software programs out there like SolidWorks or Fusion 360, you know, I started to dabble in that. I first started with SolidWorks, and that's how I designed my first product, the Titan Finger. And then I started to switch over to Fusion. So I just started to design my own stuff, and I realized that, you know, some of this stuff works pretty good. So, how do I bring it into the commercial market? So that was a learning curve for me over the years, but, I've been in business now since 2007 and, you know, just try and constantly design and improve. And with 3D printing, it allows you to do so much more, so much faster. And it just really makes my life so enjoyable when I sit down and do design work. It just allows me to kind of think about, you know, a challenging case and come up with an option, and I can have a product in my hand the next day, which is truly amazing to me.
Okay. Okay. And you know, is 3D printing play a part for you in the beginning, or did you use it much later on?
No, I've been 3D printing now for probably 10 years. I started like back, my first printer was like the Cube from 3D Systems. Yeah, then I got into using the Form Labs printers. You know, I've had the FDM printers. I started with an Ultimaker, and then moved on to the resin printers, started with the Form 2. Now we have the Form 3B, 3B Plus, which I love. And that I do a lot of one-off injection molds. That's how I make my silicone parts. And it's perfect for that. I mean, the surface finish on those are amazing. And I also have the Fuse 1, which allows me to make some more rigid frames.
Okay. Talk to us about, well, we haven't had anybody on the show that has a Fuse 1 yet. So talk to us about that. It's a compact powder bed fusion system, relatively inexpensive. Do you like it? What's it like working with it?
Love it. They've made the workflow process very efficient. And it's fairly small, fits right in my lab nicely. It comes with a cleaning station, you know, a sift station, which is very efficient. Everything just seems to make sense the way they set it up. I started using nylon 12. Nylon 12 gave me a nice surface finish, but the products that were coming out, because I make a lot of thin-walled devices, so I needed something that was not brittle. Nylon 12 seemed a little bit on the brittle side, so I switched over to nylon 11, and I really like the properties of that. So that's what I make all my a lot of my designs with now. So I usually, a lot of my stuff involves some sort of silicone interfacing, which I use on the Form 3, and then my frames are always made on the Fuse 1.
Okay, that's cool. And so Form Labs is a desktop 3D printer company, then the Pro segment, that kind of like basically invented the Pro segment. And would you recommend their systems? Because I have one. I think it's great. I have two of them, actually. I think they're great, right? I think the software is great. It's really slick experience. It's much more kind of like, you know, push button 3D printing. Then on the FDM side, we get a lot of stuff. Would you agree with that? Or
oh, I totally agree with it. Everything just, like I said, makes sense. You know, everything's very smooth and easy to operate. Their software is really nice. I've been using them for several years now, so I'm just, it'd be tough to switch because I really don't have any complaints. You know, their customer service is really good. They have a large resin selection. I love using it, and the surface finish on it is amazing. I use a clear resin because I'm not really looking for durability on those molds, because I actually just shatter them. So it's nice. I do some thin walled injection molds, so I just shatter the molds after I'm done once the silicone cures. So I mean, it's nice when I'm injection molding, I can see if there's any air bubbles or any imperfections as I'm injecting it. So that material works perfect for what I'm using it for.
And why do you use that process? Because there's other ways of getting to silicone molds and stuff like that. Why do you use 3D printing plus, like, the clear part? I think is really clear. I think it's a great idea. But why do you use this particular process? Like silicone, just because of softness, I imagine, but why this particular workflow?
So I wanted to automate the process because a lot of the silicone work that we do in our industry is custom made, you know, by a technician. And this process doesn't require a technician, and it just requires me to design on the computer so I can precisely come up with my wall thicknesses. Like with partial hand stuff, you really want to keep stuff low profile. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to gauge when you're making something by hand to keep an even thickness or a specified thickness. But on the computer, I can design it to be an exact 16th of an inch. And when I create my mold and injection mold it, break that part out, it's exactly a 16th of an inch. So the reason I designed that process, that workflow process, was it allowed me to be more precise on my designs.
Okay. And first off, is there anything you would change? I mean, or do you think that there's a better process out there? You could thermoform the molds, for example. You could use you could make a positive. You could there's tons of different stuff. You could 3D print directly in silicone. Have you looked at the alternatives to this or not really?
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at some 3D printers for silicone. They just seemed quite expensive, and the small build volumes was kind of a deterrent for me. I've tried using silicone-like 3D printed materials, and they just weren't durable enough, and it needed to be biocompatible. So the material that I'm using is from a company that makes molds for like mold making and stuff, and it's all biocompatible. It's safe on the skin. Extremely durable. So I can get a very thin silicone interface that's really strong and durable, and I can pigment it whatever color I want. So just a lot of freedoms with this design process.
Okay. So they use the fuse for the rigid parts, right?
Yep.
And what kind of components? Is this like assemblies or is it like fingers? What were we talking about?
Yeah, so what I really like about the fuse is you could print moving parts with pretty tight tolerance. So I've been trying to push the limits on that, and I've gotten down to 6,000 clearance of moving parts. So I design a lot of my new parts that have articulations. I design the articulation right into the part, so I don't have to do any assembly. So it comes out already assembled and articulating. And usually all I need to do is install maybe a spring or something like that to finish up the assembly. But a lot of my new designs moving forward now, I'm trying to design hardwareless and then also integrate them right into the 3D printed frame, so it's all one piece.
Yeah, I think that's a really great idea. Like complex assemblies, we haven't really discussed this yet, but complex assemblies is one of the big business cases for 3D printing. We're typically more expensive, but if something needs to be, you know, 15 different parts consolidated into one as a moving thing, like kind of joint finger type of assembly, then we can really save people costs, and also just like assembly cost, and also just design cost, and we can also make things relatively compact. If we try to experiment with that as well to make those, because I would guess for finger, that's kind of really important, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest challenges is in designing fingers is everything's got to be on a small scale. And, you know, how do you make something small and durable, you know, with small, thin walls or, you know, thin parts? You know, sometimes it's hard to get the durability you want, in that small space. So yeah, it becomes a challenge.
And then Brent mentioned you also did a little bit of stuff with MJF and stuff like that. When do you turn to MJF? Cause you've got your own, like powder fusion kind of small system in house. When do you want like a bigger system?
So, you know, sometimes I'll outsource, you know, if I'm doing large volume stuff, like a lot of my stuff that I keep in inventory, I'll have 3D printed and I just outsource that. And I have a vapor smooth, give me a nice surface finish, like just on some assembly parts, like some dummies or just some pieces that I use in some of the process that I don't necessarily want to do myself. I'll just outsource them. You know, if I got to order 100 or 200 pieces of something, I just have somebody else do that for me.
And how do you find a right outsourcing partner? What's the thing? Because how do you find a relate? You know, you kind of build up a relationship with them, and then there's cheap ones. Maybe there's ones that kind of do a lot of engineering work for you. Like, what for you? Like the criteria? What was like, you know, in finding a partner?
You know, I just kind of shopped around and looked around, and I ended up working with Xometry. They've seemed to do some nice work for me over the years. And I don't use them that often, but when I want to run 100 parts, and in my business, 100 parts could last me a while. So it's not like I'm running 100 parts every day. You know, it's, you know, every few months maybe I'm putting in these orders. It just seemed like a very easy process. You just run through it online, upload your part, and they give you a quote. You pick your material, you pick your, you know, your options, and you hit send, and, you know, 10 days later or whatever, you get the parts in the mail. It just seemed to be a very smooth working process for me, and I just felt comfortable with them.
I think that's a really good thing. I mean, these services really have the potential to commoditize this or to make it like significantly cheaper for everyone. So it's good to know that works for you. And do you, like, on 3D printing itself, like your workflow, you said like right now you're using a lot of Fusion 360. Do you use any other software or any other stuff like that?
Primarily, I'm just using Fusion 360 and Freeform. And to me, they work really well with it, because I'll do like a lot of my CAD designs, I'll do in Fusion, and I just bring them over into Freeform when I want to merge them into some more organic designs.
Yeah, and I love that workflow with the Freeform. Now, do you use Freeform or Freeform Plus?
Just a Freeform.
And then for your Fusion 360 stuff, I noticed that you have a lot of machine parts too. Are you doing any machining in-house for your Titan partial fingers and your thumbs?
Nope, I outsource those. I have a local machine shop that I've been working with for years.
Okay. Yeah, that's really neat. Now, do any of your fingers have, like, because I know screens are kind of a big deal, the, what do they call it, capacitance?
Yeah, that's one of the new projects I've been working on. I've been trying to get that. And, you know, with the ability to create these injection molds, because that's how I'm making all my fingertips now, with silicone injection molds. I'm looking at a way to integrate some sort of capacitive tip into there. So I got to actually just recently, it's funny you bring that up, because I just recently bought a bunch of stuff just to test and start to kind of work through that process to see if I can get some sort of capacitive tip on there.
And what is that? What is a capacitive tip? I have no idea, right? I know nothing. That's a goal.
Touch sensitive, so you can use your phone and stuff like that.
Okay. So, oh my God, that's so important. I never thought of that. It's like, I never thought of that. You're completely locked out of that using your phone with that one hand. Otherwise, that could be okay. So, and is that something you get requests for, or is it just kind of something that's trendy?
It's trending. Yeah, some of the manufacturers now are coming out with that, the ability to add that tip on.
And how much of what you do is like customized, like per person? How much is like a series kind of thing? We basically do the same components for everyone.
So the components, the stuff that I design in Fusion, pretty much are like small, medium, or large type stuff. You know, maybe 3-4 sizes, 5 sizes. But all the socket stuff, that's all custom designed. And my workflow with that is, I would get a mold from the clinician. I pour it with plaster, and then I have a 3D scanner that I scan the model, and then I do all my design work off that 3D model.
And so you're in a market really where you sell kind of to the customer, but there's a clinician in the middle of that. Who do you actually sell to? Who's your actual customer? Who do you actually interface with?
So I don't sell direct to patients or customers. I would sell directly to, I have a distributor that I use, College Park Industries. They do all my distribution. And then, so I would sell direct to them, and then they would ship it out to the customer. But all the orders come in, you know, they would order like, say, a small M finger, you know, the mounting plate, you know, all the parts that go into it. And I would do the assembly and then ship it out to them.
Okay. And is this like, are you doing this as a business? Do you have a lot of people helping you? What kind of, like, how big is this effort of yours?
So it's my business, Partial Line Solutions, has been around since 2007, and it's always been kind of like a side business of mine. A lot of nights, a lot of weekends, you know, just, in my free time, I put stuff together and get it shipped out. It's been good because it's allowed me to, just do it on my own time. You know, I work full time, for a company called Hanger Clinic. I'm one of the national upper limb prosthetic specialists with that company. I've been doing that for 20 something years. So that's my full-time job. And then, this business here is more of a part-time job for me.
Okay, but I think that's fine. And would you say that, because it's always like in the story that 3D printing democratizes innovation and makes it possible for, and is it in your case, is it possible to do this as a kind of part-time gig because of the 3D printing? Does it really enable you to really get the volumes and the innovations and the iterations in there that allow you to, you know, make it more likely that you could actually afford to do this?
Yeah. No, I mean, like I said, I've been doing it for years, so I just figure out time. And to me, it's not really a job. I've always looked at this as kind of just a hobby, and I'm just very passionate about it. I love what I do. So, you know, if I'm up late at night doing something, it's not really work for me. You know, it's just something that I enjoy doing. So I've always been able to find time to kind of get innovative and kind of work through the jobs that are coming in. So. Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of hours, but like I said, it's just fun and enjoyable for me.
It looks like you use a lot of like the Click Medical stuff. I like how you're kind of incorporating that in, so it's not only for volume fluctuation or even for fit. It looks like it is for pre-positioning of fingers and such. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the BOA I use on my M-finger system, that allows the user to adjust the cable tension. So if they want more or less cable tension, they can just quickly adjust that dial. I've been using them for many years now. It's a nice little option just to give some cable adjustment for the user.
And I'm a huge BOA fan, by the way. And is there any alternative to that, really? Or do you have to use them? Or is it just so unique that you can get that fit in this kind of, you know, well-defined, predefined package? Or why did you choose to use them?
It just seemed to fit, you know. It was low profile. It gave me the features that I wanted. I wanted the ability, because the M fingers are driven off wrist motion. So it's just a quick connection between the forearm segment of the prosthesis and the hand segment of the prosthesis. So it allows the user to adjust the cable tension. So when they go to grab something, they could either get more or less grip force depending on their needs for that specific activity. And it's quick to change the cable length. A lot of patients will just kind of set it, forget it, but it does give them the freedom for adjustability if they need it.
Okay,
I haven't really experimented with too many other options just because that seems to work. But I'm sure there could be other options out there.
And have you thought of, like, to make these grip better, have you thought of, like, making more, like, 3D printed kind of structures on the fingertips, or kind of more definition or patterns that can increase that grip? Have you looked at that at all? Or?
Yeah, so now, since I've been starting the injection molding process, I've been doing that. I've been creating some sort of textured grip on there, but the silicone alone gives a nice grippy surface.
Okay, that's cool. And do you think, like, so what's it like for you? Like, okay, how do you find customers? Is it just word of mouth? Do people just like tell each other about you, or how does that work?
A lot of it's word of mouth. Yeah. Like I said, I've been in the business for almost 25 years now, and always had a large focus on partial hands. So I've just developed relationships over the years, and you know, a lot of people will reach out to me to consult on certain cases, and you know, that's a big part of what I do too. Also is just consulting with other clinicians.
And what's the kind of the state of the art? Like, you mentioned that when you got started, the partial hand thing was kind of like not great, or there was not a lot happening there, let's say. So what's kind of the state of the art now with partial hand? Are we getting a lot better at treating that? Is it much more functional for the customer?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, several years ago, a lot of new companies have come out, like Naked Prosthetics, Point Designs, you know, Oster has some products. You know, there's a lot of innovative companies out there that have some really nice products out there. So it's great to see those as an option, because we fit a lot of those. I fit a lot of those, and they just work out really nice. It's really well designed, really good companies to work with, and they create some really nice products. So I've definitely seen some big improvements over the years.
Okay. And are you in the, because we've seen kind of a divergence, because it used to be, these things used to be kind of like a little plastic hand. It was kind of like a plasticky human skin color. You know, and now it's gone to people going into like the really cool carbon fiber look, like, yeah, it's a robot. You know, what are you feeling on those two kind of things for fingers? Does it matter to you that it has to look really human-like, or do you think it's really cool to make it look like really advanced, or how's that, or you're like, no, it's about the function. I couldn't care what it looks like.
Well, I think a lot of patients now have been transitioning over to that kind of cool robotic look. And a lot of the hand manufacturers out there now are going more towards that look as opposed to like a cosmetic cover that goes over it. One of the other things that I do in my lab is I have a hydrographics lab, so I can do all custom painting and custom graphics. So any of the stuff that I print, I could either put a graphic film over it or do a custom painting on it. And I get a lot of requests for that. You know, that not often do I get a customer asking for a skin tone. A lot of customers are asking for like camel patterns or carbon fiber or something like that over it. So I can do all that sort of the graphic applications on any of the devices that I provide.
Camo pattern? That is like the most American thing ever. A real tree prosthetic?
Yeah. Yeah, we get a lot of clients. I use a company, and I just usually send the clinician to that website to pick out a pattern, and then they would send me the name of the pattern. I order it, and then I just I'll add that onto the device once it comes in.
Okay. Oh wow. And so you guys like and in that kind of stylistic thing. And what's driving this demand thing? What do people want more from their hands that they're not, or they're these partial prosthetics that they're not getting now? What is it that people are coming back and saying, "Look, I got this thing 10 years ago. I want the latest and the greatest"? Or,
well, I think some of it is what options are available. I think a lot of the new manufacturers now aren't really super focused on the cosmetic end of things. You know, they're more focused on providing maximizing the patient's function. So a lot of the devices now, like I mentioned, you know, companies like Naked Prosthetics or Point Designs or OS, a lot of their products aren't necessarily cosmetic. They're designed for function. You probably could put some sort of cosmetic glove over it if you wanted to, but it's going to diminish the function somewhat because those devices are meant to kind of move freely. And once you put silicone over something that articulates, it kind of diminishes some of the functions of the device.
Okay. Okay. And about that, okay, about powering the device, right? So you're, well, okay, are you in this body powered electronic camp? Is that, or do you just use both, whatever, is better?
So my company is primarily body powered. But, you know, when like I said, I also work for Hanger Clinic, and we fit all sorts of devices, whether it's mechanical, body powered, electronic. So I guess it's depending on which hat I'm wearing, you know, but my company, Partial End Solutions, primarily focuses on body power.
And why is that? Was that just easier to fancy yourself more, or is there like actual, or were there significant benefits to that?
I don't know. It's just kind of been something I've always focused on. You know, back when I started, my first prototype I had made prior to having a 3D printer. And like I said, I grew up working in woodworking, and I had all the woodworking tools. So I made my first M finger with a wood router. I just kind of whittled everything out and put it together, and it articulated the way I wanted it to. And I reached out to my boss at the time, and I said, "Hey, I got this design that, you know, kind of functions the way I want it to. What do you think about it?" He goes, "Well, put four together, put a thumb on there, and come on down here and we'll fit one." So I went down there and fit it. Worked just the way I was hoping it would. So that's kind of what started the process of me trying to figure out, all right, so now how do I take this concept into reality and make it a product? So that was a learning curve for me back in the day, was, you know, hiring engineers, you know, starting the business, you know, finding injection molders, all this kind of stuff. So the first products that I developed were injection molded, which now I probably would never do that just because it was a significant expense and the volume just wasn't there. So now that I have the ability to use a 3D printer, anything I design now, my thought process is that it just needs to be 3D printed. How do I design it that way? So my whole process of designing to manufacture has changed over the years.
Okay. That's really interesting to see. Like, and what impact does that have on the devices?
It allows me to be more custom. You know, if you injection mold something, it is what it is. If you have the ability to change and modify the design over time, it allows you to continually evolve and improve on the product, you know, on the fly.
Now this is your day to day at like upper extremity, partial hands, partial fingers. And like a clinician like me, it's not something that I see every day. What would you say, you know, to somebody like me or somebody that say that has less experience, but has a partial finger, partial hand person come into the clinic, where do you get started? Where do you look for help? Do you say, hey, this isn't, I mean, even though it's technically part of my scope of practice, what do you suggest to people, you know, that may find themselves in a similar position as me with a partial hand person coming in?
Yeah. So the way you described it is a lot of the clinicians out there, just a lot of clinicians just don't see partial hand patients on a routine basis. So a lot of times when a patient does come in, a lot of it's new. So I usually just have the clinicians reach out to me and send me some photos, send me some videos. I can talk through the design process. And what I'll do also is a lot of times when a clinician will send in a photo, what I'll do is I have a 3D model of a hand, and I'll amputate the 3D model to resemble the patient's hand. And I can sketch up a model design to show them kind of what I'm talking about as far as socket design, finger selection, you know, trim lines, all that kind of stuff. So it gives the clinician and the patient a better understanding of what to expect. And then if I do the fabrication and design work, I try to set it up where there's not much work on the clinical side. So when the clinician gets it, it's fit, maybe do some minor adjustments, and then patient goes home with it. So I try to make it pretty user friendly for the clinician if they haven't had much experience fitting these devices.
What would you say is the biggest mistake people make? Is it not asking for help, or is it bigger than that?
I think that's a big part of it too. A lot of times, a lot of clinicians will fit components primarily based on the amputation level, which I don't think is, and sometimes it's appropriate, but when you have multiple fingers at multiple levels of amputation, sometimes just fitting a patient's finger merely based on the component that could be appropriate for that level may not work out, because when you start putting everything together, sometimes it does, sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't, you know? So talking it through, working through the process, trying to give the clinician a better understanding of, if you use this component with that component, these are some of the challenges you may experience. You know, lengths may be off, function may be diminished because of, you know, these particular issues that may come up. So I try and walk through the whole potential issues down the road with the clinician before they move forward with anything. Because the last thing you want to do is put a patient through all this and then realize at the end it doesn't work. So we want to try and, you know, minimize those challenges.
And I see on your website that, you know, you've got the cute girl with the glasses and the dress on the swing and all that. Like the pediatric stuff, how important is it to get kids into a prosthesis early on? You know, because now you've got a whole body of knowledge and work behind you, and you've seen the increase abilities and technology and such. So, you know, you kind of hear things all across the map. So I'd kind of just love to hear your opinion on that.
So with kids, I always like to talk with the parents and say, listen, it doesn't hurt to try. You know, if you want to introduce prosthetics to your child in an early age, that's fine, but I wouldn't really push it. You know, if it's something that they just, especially with a congenital, you know, now you're adding a prosthesis on there, which to them is not normal. You know, for anybody, it's not normal, but for somebody who was born without a limb, that's their normal. So trying to add something in that space, they may not appreciate it. So I wouldn't want to like force it on a child at that early age. You know, you introduce it, you know, maybe start with something very simple and see if they accept it. And then you can go kind of progress from there. These kids grow out of these devices fairly quickly. So you could start pretty simple, see where some of the challenges are, see where some of the advantages are. And then you can, on the next design or next iteration, if they continue to move forward, then you could look at changing the design. One thing you don't want to do is with kids is kind of overcomplicate things initially, because, you know, weight is a big issue. You don't want to make the device too heavy, too complicated, because if they get frustrated, they're just going to say, get this thing off me. I just want to go play in the sand, you know? So yeah, my thought process with kids is to start simple, start light, and then have a discussion with the parents about, you know, kind of the process, you know, over the lifetime, these are kind of what you could expect. So just kind of walk through a time frame and give them a better understanding of, you know, what's going to work potentially and, you know, what may not work long term.
And is it in your case, is the partial hand stuff, is that mostly trauma, or is that, or what are the causes for the stuff?
That's a mix. You know, it could be trauma, it could be congenital. Brent, the case that you had discussed on my website, that was an interesting case. So the mother had reached out to me on that one. And she says, can you make my daughter a hand? I'm like, well, I don't do pediatrics. This is before the pediatric M finger came out. And then I said, well, you know, I'll think about it. And then she reached out to me like a week or so later, says, hey, you know, some following up, you know, see if you can, you know, make my daughter a hand, consider making my daughter a hand. I'm like, well, you know, I'll work on it. You know, I've got a lot of stuff I'm going on right now. I was just wasn't really in the thought process of designing a prosthetic finger for pediatrics. But, you know, that's one of the nice things about the software program. All I did was scale down my adult version and then just re-engineer the hardware. And that's kind of how the pediatric M finger came to light, was that particular patient. Patient's mom, God bless her, was persistent, and I was able to make a product out of it. So, and she's had several of them already. As she grows, we just make her new sets. So, it's been very effective for them.
And how important is it, like, to understand the patient? Like, we've heard a lot of, like, to varying degrees, either the lifestyle and what the patient's doing is, like, super duper important or not so much. Like, how important is it for this partial hand stuff? Do you need to go deep into their lives and understand if they're, like, you know, they want to climb stuff, or if they're kind of a more of a book reader type of person? How much do you need to know about them?
Yeah, we do a very thorough evaluation. We want to get a good understanding of what their needs and goals are. So we try and focus on, you know, what can we provide you based upon the feedback that we're getting from you? So if they come back and say, you know, listen, I'm a landscaper, I'm out in the environment, you know, it's going to get muddy, it's going to get dirty, I need to pick up heavy weights, you know, that's going to kind of drive you into one particular kind of system. And not necessarily one system is going to meet all their needs and goals. So, you know, some patients may require a certain device for work and then a certain device for, you know, other activities, just activities of daily living. So yeah, a lot of that stuff that you mentioned, that's a big factor in how we design the device for the patient.
Yeah. And I know it's also on your site, you've got this thing called a Hold It, which is essentially like a kind of holder for a pen and stuff like that. I can imagine that for a lot of things, something like that would actually be like way more easier to use than like a kind of thumb or finger or something like that. Do you see a lot, or is that kind of like the, but it also seems kind of like old school when compared to like these more robotic looking devices, or is there a lot of future for devices like that?
Yeah. So that's a very simple device that I designed really specifically for someone who, say, was a bilateral partial hand patient who just wanted to eat. You know, they can put a knife in one of them and a fork in another, and they can position it. They can interchange components. You know, they can put their toothbrush in there. It's a very useful tool for those kind of things. You know, anything that you could fit up to a 7/8 of an inch in there. So a knife, a fork, a spoon, you know, those kind of things. It's very effective for those patients because, you know, you're basically just giving them a nice secure grasp on that knife and fork. And it definitely improves their ability to eat and take care of themselves.
Okay. That's really cool. And if we look at this kind of stuff, like okay, you mentioned that there's, okay, if I'm a gardener or something like that, then maybe there's like a tough kind of outdoor device and maybe something a little bit more precise that I need as well. You know, there's a lot of design constraints there. So what's the difficult bit? Is it strength? Is it dexterity? What's the hard stuff?
Yeah, so if they're doing like a lot of shoveling and digging and stuff, you're probably leaning more towards like a grip lock or point design or Titan finger, you know, something heavy duty and locking. That's going to give them a nice, secure, locked grip. You know, partial M fingers, M fingers, those will be great for positioning, but not necessarily for like heavy grip, you know, high grip force. You know, so that those come into play as far as the design process. You know, do they need to pick up heavy things? Are they out in the environment? You know, that's also, you know, if you're looking at electronic fingers, you know, that could be a challenge if somebody's a landscaper or out in the environment, you know, heavy duty lifting, you know, that may not be the best option. But, you know, electronic fingers certainly have their functional use in our industry. They're very, very functional, very nice product. But in certain cases, it's not appropriate, like in that specific case I just mentioned, like landscaping.
When you're looking at the patient's activity level and such, and you're kind of designing and choosing, say, a product, whether it's, you know, a product from your own portfolio or not, so, breakage is always a thing for upper extremity amputees in general. Do you, like, So if you have their activity level, do you also add, say, a quote-unquote safety factor to that just so it doesn't break? Or, like, how close to that line do you, have you found in your experience is it important to be at where you have the function to over-engineering?
That's a good point. Yeah. So a lot of times, you know, if the clinician does say, yeah, patient's a heavy duty user, you know, sometimes they will beef up design, but you also got to be a little careful. Like I said earlier, with partial hands, the frame designs, they got to be pretty low profile, especially if you're fitting multiple fingers, because, you know, once you start adding the silicone and frame thickness on each finger, it can get kind of bulky. So if you're over-engineering it to make it really robust and beefy, you know, now the patient may not even want to wear it just because it's too bulky. So those are all things you got to kind of take into consideration. And that's what's really cool about 3D design is you could create strength where it needs to be and remove everything else to keep it low profile as can be. And then the components themselves, if I know I need to beef them up, I can just add some thickness to the actual components too to make them a little bit stronger.
And that could be really interesting. Have you looked at like carbon fiber 3D printing at all? You've got like 9T labs, impossible objects, these kind of things. Is that like the kind of holy grail for you? Or is that something that you're like, no, it's fine. It's not really that exciting. Because there you can also do selective loading and all this kind of stuff, right?
No, that would be great. You know, my ultimate goal would be to get the strongest device with the thinnest and smallest build volume. So make something as low profile as possible at the maximum strength. I do like the nylon 11 because it does have a little flex to it. It's not brittle, so it's not going to really crack. But now that I know the properties of that material, I usually do my design work based on my knowledge of how that material is going to react. So if I want to create a very thin socket wall, I'm going to reinforce it somewhere else if I need to compensate for some of that flex that I know is going to happen. So a lot of it's just kind of walking through your head, you know, yeah, I want this cut out here, but that's going to affect my overall stability of the frame. So I got to add some thickness somewhere else. And where can I do that where it makes the most sense? That's what's so cool about it is you can just get in there and, you know, add specific thicknesses and trim lines where necessary to kind of maximize the design feature.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. And for you, is there like a, you know, is there like a technology you're missing or like, you know, specific strength within a wall thickness? It seems like it would always be of interest, right? But is there actually some kind of leap you've been wanting or you know, could it be simple as like a simple servo that's really small or something, or like a cable that works in a better way? Or is there stuff that you're really missing?
Not that I could think of at this point now. Like I said, everything I do is just truly custom. So if, as I start trimming away and making a design look the way I want it to look, then I kind of step back and look at it and say, all right, what do I need to add here to give me the properties of this socket that I need? I don't know, what I would add to that, but other than just, you know, kind of getting creative with the design to give it the features that it needs to have.
Yeah. And we always like, okay, this is like a whole area of research, like soft robotics. We're talking about bladders and air bladders and pneumatics and soft muscles. And then all these kind of 3D printed actuators and stuff like that. And, you know, soft robotics has always been this kind of really cool idea without really a lot of applications, but it looks like this 3D printed muscle type of tissue stuff would actually maybe make sense of what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with that. I haven't seen that.
Okay, you should totally check it out. It's like basically it's a field of study where all these people are trying to make robots that are soft, essentially. So the idea is to have an actuator that doesn't have any metal in it, any cast components, or any real like electronics as we know it, but maybe kind of like a bladder that can extend and get smaller, like a small air pocket that's usually 3D printed or made by some kind of molding process. And then it gets heated or there's a chemical reaction and it retracts. And the idea is to make like robotics in a completely new way. And the idea is not to have like a Roomba that has like lots and lots of like components that come from all over the world, but maybe it's like a much more organic type of shape that, you know, if the temperature in the room changes, it moves through your house or something like that, like a really different type of robotics. And one of the things these guys are always looking for is these, you know, these kind of 3D printed, usually actuators. There's actually a lot of research on it, but it's all really custom and it could be a really fun, like kind of research thing because these guys are always looking for applications. They're never really succeeding really, to be honest.
Yeah. Huh. That's interesting.
And so for you, I think it's really interesting that you do this kind of as a, like a part-time gig. I think that's really cool that you would be like, no, you know what I need in my life? More prosthetics.
Yeah.
But is there like, you know, is it difficult for an entrepreneur to find an audience in this market, apart from, of course, these people that know you and trust you and keep coming back, right? Because you don't have the scale to make a big slash or some show or something like that. Like, is it difficult to kind of find the audience because it's so fragmented because everyone's so far away and all this?
I don't know. I guess I just kind of fell into it, you know, just for doing it for so many years and kind of specializing in it. I think I've just kind of developed that network of people over the years. One of the other things that I've done, I've always been a professor at the University of Hartford, or an adjunct professor now. So I've worked with a lot of students that are now clinicians over the years. So that's just another network out there that, you know, and I always tell the students, you know, reach out to me if you have any questions, because I teach the partial hand or the upper limb, or assist with teaching the upper limb program for the University of Hartford. So that's just another opportunity to network and develop relationships with students that are now clinicians. And it's great. You know, I could talk to a student that I haven't talked to in 15 years. It'll call me up and say, "Hey, I was a student of yours 15 years ago. I got this patient coming in. You mind chatting a little bit?" And, you know, to me, that's rewarding just to see that, you know, patients or clinicians still reach out to me for advice.
That's super cool. And do you think that your area of study gets a lot of, like, you know, do you get a lot of time in the classroom for people? Or do you find it kind of like, you know, it doesn't get enough kind of say, let's say?
Well, I think it's, you know, upper limb in general is a small percentage of the patient care, patient population that we see. It's probably, you know, 8 or 10%. So it's probably equivalent in the amount of education that they get. You know, I don't think it's equal to, say, lower limb or spinal or something that's a little more prevalent in practice. But, you know, when we go through our program, we go through fittings, designs, components, talk about technology, we bring in manufacturers, you know, so we kind of give them a full gamut of everything that's out there in a condensed version. So they get a good education on upper limb, and they get some hands on, we get patient models in, and we'll go through fittings and stuff like that. So, it's just, it's hard to teach them everything if it's something that they're probably not going to see much of.
And just generally, I think, how do you think the future of like, because if you ask anyone, you may be like me, know nothing about this partial finger stuff, and you're going to ask people about the future, and they're going to be, yeah, robots. It's going to be robot fingers. That's what it's going to be. Do you believe in something like that, or do you think there's other more classical technologies have a real role to play?
Robot stuff would be cool. I mean, the challenge you run into is, how do you get something in a small space that has all these things? You know, how do you power it? How do you motorize it? You know, if you're missing a part of your finger, where do you put all that stuff? You know, that's the challenge now. And that's why a lot of stuff's more mechanical now, because you can fit that into that small space more so than you could electronic components. That'd be great. I think the 3D printing and design process now that a lot of clinicians now are getting into, I think that's only going to pave the way for, you know, improved designs over the years, you know, because now we have the ability to kind of change things more rapidly.
Okay, that's super cool. And like, I imagine I'm like a young prosthetist, or just like, you know, I'm kind of at a point where I want to specialize in your area, like finger, partial hand, that kind of thing. What would you say to me? Like, don't do it? what advice would you give me?
I mean, I would absolutely say do it. I mean, I love it. You know, that's one of my big passions. And I would say, if it's something that you enjoy and you want to pursue, then definitely dive in. And you know, the challenge is, how do you get that patient population to come to you? You know, if you're new, you know, it's one of those things where you're not going to probably see a large volume of patients if you're in one office. So the reason I see so many patients, you know, especially partial hand patients, is I travel, you know, a fairly large region with Hanger Clinic. So I see patients all in New England, New York, and New Jersey. I go to them. You know, they don't necessarily come to me. So I'm traveling to go see them. So that's why I probably see a larger volume of partial hand patients than most.
Okay, that's really good advice. I think that's it. So you find the patient. You really have to go looking for them, which is probably not the case in a lot of other areas too. And how about this 3D printing thing? It looks like you kind of figured this stuff out kind of by yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting. So when I first started out, I was looking at design software. So I ended up making an investment in SolidWorks. And I learned SolidWorks just by watching their tutorials. You know, I'd watch a tutorial, I'd play around with it, watch another tutorial, play around with it. And that's how I developed the first Titan finger. And it took me about 2 years because most of it was just trying to figure out the program. And then, okay, now how do I design this thing? And now that I've switched over to Fusion, I just think Fusion 360 is just works well with what I do as far as 3D printing and stuff. So I've kind of put SolidWorks by the wayside. Nothing wrong with the program. It's just I'm just getting more accustomed to using Fusion 360.
And how about just the more 3D printing specific stuff? Like, for example, there's quite a lot of stuff online. We had somebody up on the other day and they were advising us, like, you know, go with the FDM printer, the material extrusion printer with the largest community. They'll teach you and they'll help you. But, you know, if we look at the Forum Labs, the 3L and the Fuse, there's not a lot of community out there, and they're less, well, there's more companies. So they less openly talk about their failures and what they can't do, because it's kind of embarrassing to say, like, you know, I work at the Air Force and I can't do this, you know, and they just can't, they're not allowed to say that. So how do you get in touch with that, that learning on more of these Fuse and these Forum Lab systems?
I've always had a good relationship with them. I made a connection with one of the customer service, people over there, and I, just reach out to them when I have any questions. And they've been really good with me as far as getting any service. The nice thing is I rarely have to service these things. I just do my routine maintenance on them. It's rare that anything breaks or malfunctions or I have a failed print. They've been pretty solid products for me. So, when you first start out, if you buy one of these $150 printers, you know, it's likely that you're not going to get someone answering the phone and giving you quality customer service. I mean, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But I now moving forward, I like to look at the customer service side of things and before I buy anything. So, and I've had good success with Forum Labs. They've always been good to me, and it's been a reliable company. That's why I keep going back.
Okay, super cool. Hey, Matt, thank you so much for your journey. I think it's awesome that you're doing this for work and also for play, let's say, and you're making such cool innovations that really change people's lives. So thanks for that, and thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Brent, thank you for being here today.
Oh, yeah, this was a good one. And Matt, I knew you had a practice. I didn't realize that you were upper extremity specialist for our that northeast corner. So that's super cool to know. And man, I don't know when you sleep, you know, with all with all the stuff doing with the partial hand stuff and learning the stuff on your own, because it truly is kind of the wild, wild west. So yes, thank you for sharing your story and your journey. And I know our listeners will get a lot from it for sure.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. So the next section is the news. So yeah, we're looking at the orthotics prosthetics news of the day or the week or the time period, and we have a sponsor for this as well, don't we?
Yes, we do, and that sponsor is Jess Poto. And people are like, what is Jess Poto? Well, Jess Poto is just coming to the U.S. It's a Belgian company that does and helps kind of democratize design for the orthotic and prosthetic field. And so they started off with automated design for foot orthoses, and now it's really going towards AFOs and KAFOs, knee orthoses, that sort of thing, SMOs. And so I'm really excited about sharing their journey as they're growing into this space. And then we're also going to be helping guide them into this space as well, for use on our everyday printing and design. So I'm really excited to have them as a sponsor as well.
And how do you spell that? What's that?
GESPODO.
Okay. All right. So check that out. Okay. Super cool. Okay. So what is the news for today? So we've been looking and I found something quite interesting, because I thought, this is something that there's one of these things where you can kind of, well, it's a fun thing to discuss. So we thought it would be nice to talk about it and for you guys to discuss as well amongst yourselves, your friends, colleagues, that kind of thing. Now, there's a thing called Nerd Forge. Nerd Forge is a couple, Martina and Hensi. I don't know if they're like a romantic couple, but definitely they're a team, let's say. And they have over 2 million subscribers on YouTube. They regularly get like 3-4 million followers on our video views. And they get like, you know, nearly 500,000 followers on Instagram. And they do really cool, well, Nerd Forge things. Like she'll make a big magic book or a tower. Kind of gothic-y magic of the future type of a scenario. And the presenter is Martina, and she shows how to make things. So that's super laudable and super cool. And there's a bunch of 3D printing stuff in there as well. So what happened? All right. So Martina, at one point, years ago, lost her pinky in a circular saw, a saw accident of some kind. I think a bandsaw. Well, I guess it's probably a circular saw of some kind. And she lost her pinky. And right now, for a video this last week, she decided to 3D print her very own prosthesis, right? This actually happened 3 months ago. But what happened is that video got 4.9 million views, and the 3D printing industry just got like wind of this just now. And now it's all making rounds in 3D printing land, and everybody's talking about Martina's finger. And she uses a Prusa SL1, which is a grid 3D printer, by the way. It's a resin 3D printer to make this finger herself. And I'm inspired and also really worried.
So well, I think it's an interesting story. And I think what's cool about the story is, yes, she was able to do that, but she's a very skilled person as well, at doing this. And she knows, kind of what her limits are as far as the printing technology and that sort of thing. And the other thing that's interesting is you don't see all the multiple iterations that go on. You see some of the failures, but you can tell that there was a lot of work that went into making these devices, and they work kind of so-so. So, I always love it when people kind of fix their own prosthesis or problem. I think where things kind of go sideways is they're like, hey, we just fixed our own problem for 23 cents and you can do the same thing. And that's where things go sideways for me.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's a valid point. I mean, to me, okay, I worry about, okay, so maybe this is a good point to bring this up. Like if we're looking at resin printing, vat polymerization, SLA, DLP, it's been called a bunch of different things. Essentially what we're doing is we're taking a resin that has a photo initiator in it. That resin may actually have carcinogenic materials in it. And that photo initiator, that's the thing that actually hardens it when it's exposed to light, is a skin irritant. So if you're continuously exposed to this, you may actually develop a reaction that is kind of a skin kind of allergic kind of reaction, which could be very bad actually. There's other ill health effects of these resins. Now it depends on the resin, of course. If we wanted to be using this for kind of a patient scenario or that kind of thing, we really want biocompatible materials. We really want safe materials. Even in those, there's been some issues of maybe them leaching out of these kind of parts. On top of that, when you're doing this, and if you're doing this day in, day out, if you work with one of these machines for like 20 years of your life, you need to be really careful to continue exposure to the resin, this liquid material. Because like it's a little bit and a little spatter will get on your face and like, you know, a little bit there. And I'm very careful with gloves and I even have the glasses on every time I work with this stuff, even though it gets really boring and quotidian all the time. Because this continued exposure is a risk for you or your employees should you do this professionally. Now, there's another problem as well that you have to cure this resin. And if you're making, I don't know, some desk ornament, who cares, right? You just leave it out in the sun for a while or something, or you can put it in a curing station and wash station. But if you're doing this in an end-use product from a liability point of view and a safety point of view, you really need to look deeper at the actual curing protocols of the resin supplier, the printer supplier, whoever makes your peripherals to get that right, because otherwise you're giving them an uncured product and that could fail or it could actually give them the skin issue. So I'm worried about this because I think a lot of people are just diving into, you know, 3D printing, and these materials, like like, to give you an idea, if I had a small child in the house, I wouldn't have a resin 3D printer in my house. I just wouldn't. But I would have no problem whatsoever having a material extrusion like a filament printer. So you know, I think that there's like these more risks here. So I don't, you know, I would hate to see too many people experiment with this and kind of. I saw a paper, for example, somebody using a resin printer to make a small part for a baby, like a kind of prosthetic kind of thing. And then they noticed that one of the things in this research was that the baby had a small rash, but they didn't think that that would be a problem. And I'm like, well, I don't think you know, because you did something that was really stupid, and you shouldn't use a baby and a resin-made part on that baby, because there's a lot of risk there. So I think, you know, I love the fact that she's empowered. I love the fact that she's, you know, showing people this is a cool thing to make your own thing. And I love the fact that, you know, we know that good verbal patients that demand what they want and explain are really powerful. But I worry about, like, you know, just this 3D printing resin aspect where I'm like, I want people to be more careful, you know?
Oh, totally. And I hadn't even thought about the safety side of things of doing that. And then, you know, the long-term exposure actually right up against the skin. I think that's very interesting when it comes to the resin sort of printing. You know, the other thing that I'd be kind of curious on is, you know, 3 months from now, you know, she's doing her video, is she actually going to be wearing her finger? And if she's not, then most likely it wasn't the, you know, it wasn't providing her the function that she needed, wanted, or what have you. And then it's like, well, did you just do that for views or what? And it's cool nonetheless. And if you did it for views, then perfect. But, you know, I think it has become so much more than that, that it's important to educate people around, like, hey, this particular video was more about entertainment rather than, you know, form and function.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think, we both agree that this is cool that people are doing this, and kind of in a kind of perception of prosthetics way, this is really amazing. You know, it's kind of like, it's a feature. Yeah. It's a feature.
Yeah. Well, and I think it also goes to show, like, a professional, you know, prosthetist or orthotist, or somebody that's in the field. It's like, hey, your patients are going to be seeing this stuff on YouTube, and they're going to be wondering why you're not 3D printing. And you need to have a really good answer, because there's not a good answer to not be 3D printing in this field anymore.
Okay. All right. So I thought that was really cool. I think it's a fun kind of like water cooler conversation thing, you know, what to do with this and think about. We thought this was some interesting news to share with you about the democratization of 3D printing and ultimately coming into the patient's hands, which is something I think, yeah, I agree. That we need to kind of at least have a kind of scenario for that.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Prosthetics and Orthotics Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and colleagues. Have a great day.